You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 17th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. And welcome to the third edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Singapore, and at Midori House right here in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. I'm your host, Ben Ryland. On today's show, we're touching down in Singapore to explore an emerging regional hub set to make waves in this constantly evolving island city.
We have seen the state planned and put in infrastructure, as well as invited private sector to come in and invest in land. So definitely Jurong is the next big thing on the state planner's minds.
And after enjoying strong growth in core European and US markets, we'll learn why an Australian fashion designer, Dion Lee, has his eyes firmly set on the Asian market.
We really want to raise the visibility of the brand and create more of an identity for the brand for people who might not be as familiar with what we do and the background of the aesthetic.
And later in the show, we'll cross to Tokyo to hear about how a new retail and transport development is gentrifying its surroundings.
They created an all-star team, really, to help them find products from all over Japan to fill the grocery store. So it's not your typical grocery store, it's higher end, and these are products that are hard to find anywhere else.
All that plus a look ahead at the week in numbers right here on Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. I'm Ben Ryland, and this is Asia Pac Unwrapped, Monocle 24's brand new show celebrating the world's most dynamic region and sniffing out the best opportunities, whether it's places to invest, the finest destinations for a well-deserved break, or inspiring stories from the region's smartest business people. Let's start things off with a look ahead at the week in numbers now. Gwen Robinson is chief editor at Nikkei Asian Review and a regular contributor to Monocle. She's on assignment in Burma at the moment, but we have managed to track her down. Gwen, you are, of course, usually based in Bangkok, so let's start things off with some of the business news happening over there.
Well, obviously, as it has for many months, the preoccupation really is, you know, the whole regime that has taken over since last year, the military regime, and also efforts to get the economy back on track after quite a dip, which some attribute to the coup factor and also to slowing exports.
And of course, we saw what was quite a remarkable step by Thailand's central bank, allowing the baht's value to slide. Growth estimates before the coup that took place a little while ago were quite optimistic. What are the immediate effects likely to be going into this week?
Well, I think what we've got is a stock market that's beginning to, you know, there's always been this term Teflon Thailand because stocks, I mean, the stock market seems to roar along no matter what happens. It's had some hits and it took a very big hit a couple of times in this past year. But at the moment, you know, we're seeing a bit of flailing around. Investors are a little bit unsure. I think the big concern is this issue of slowing exports. So there's a lot of concentration on getting consumer confidence back on track, which is just as well because I've never seen such a slew of new glittering shopping malls and things opening. So clearly there's some desperation to get the Thai consumer back into the shops and also to sell Thailand's wares. But what we've seen also is, as a result of the coup, for example, the European Union freezing talks over a trade agreement and also warning the Thais on seafood exports and putting a temporary block on some seafood exports as a result of human rights concerns and other issues.
It's interesting to consider how Thailand's current economic situation is having quite a significant impact internationally. Of course, the country has been the subject of economic sanctions recently.
Yeah, well, and just over the border, what you've got is a really fascinating contrast, which is Myanmar, or Burma as some people still call it, which was the pariah state. And it's a really extraordinary turnaround, which is you've got the Thais now being the pariah state, with some Western governments having sanctions. And Burma, it's all systems go. There are concerns, of course, they've had a lot of condemnation, particularly over this week, the flood of refugees and people coming from Western Myanmar, the Rohingya Muslims. But overall, the government here is trying very hard to, again, you know, lure investors, sort of shore up confidence in the economy. So the big thing for the last couple of weeks, I think, is new legislation coming into place. Every week or month, we've got some sort of new rule or law that is aimed at reassuring investors that the rule of law will prevail. So the latest one is an anti-competition law, which has some actually quite draconian provisions, I think, for antitrust, competition issues. That's probably a bit on the downside. On the other hand, it provides a lot of investor protection. The government has also aimed at putting in place some regulations that protect foreign investors. So, you know, that in a way is an overall positive. And as for the economic growth forecasts, you know, you're sitting in a country that is sort of, you know, actually notching up the fastest growth of most countries in the region. So it's looking pretty good, and the contrast, as I said, is really striking.
Thanks, Gwen. We'll leave it there. Gwen Robinson there, Chief Editor at Nikkei Asian Review, joining us on the line from Burma. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. When it comes to urban development, no one does it quite like Singapore. The island city is widely known for its ever-changing landscape, with neighbourhoods constantly being torn down and rebuilt one after another. One of the government's latest projects, the Jurong Regional Hub, is now taking shape. Monocle's Jeremy Toh took a train ride over there to find out more.
Jurong East. Cross over to Platform E for train service towards Woodlands and Ang Mo Kio.
It was announced last week that the upcoming high-speed rail between Singapore and Kuala Lumpur would be terminating at the heart of Singapore's up-and-coming neighbourhood, Jurong East. The Jurong Regional Hub is touted to be the island nation's brand new business district away from the city, undergoing rapid transformation since plans were first unveiled by the government back in 2008. I spoke to Desmond Sim, Asia Pacific's head of research at commercial real estate firm CBRE, about what all these recent developments mean for the area and why people should be investing.
I think the state planners of Singapore wish to decentralise Singapore. And from that, they have identified three regional centres. One which is Tampines in the east. Jurong happens to be in the west. And we've got one more up north in Woodlands. So we have done and dusted with Tampines. Jurong is the next big thing. We have seen the state planned and put in infrastructure, as well as invited private sector to come in and invest in land to do their development. So definitely Jurong is the next big thing on the state planners' minds.
Who would you say is buying the property in the Jurong Regional Hub area? Are they locals? Are they foreigners?
Predominantly still Singaporeans. Predominantly still upgraders. Going forward, who knows, with the close links, maybe we might see more Malaysians. Maybe with the link, maybe all the way up from Malacca or even Kuala Lumpur. But that being said, property prices in Singapore, as compared to Malaysia, has been a bit more expensive. It would be for investment, definitely, and also for maybe for owner occupancy. Businesses between Malaysia and Singapore would be more closely linked, especially in the near future.
So if we're talking a bit more about, let's say not about Malaysia or Singapore, let's say we're talking about people from London or from Australia, what would you say would entice them to want to invest in the Jurong Regional Hub area?
Well, if you have international investors definitely would not leave Singapore out of their radar, because Singapore being the gateway to Southeast Asia, Singapore being a regional hub for finance, for insurance, is good to own something that's very stable in Singapore. Jurong offers something a bit more cheaper than what is put on the plate that is in the CBD core or in the prime market. So if going forward, if there are more opportunities for residential investment, Jurong would be an ideal spot because at least there is a growth story behind it. At the same time, with growth story, at least possibly we can garner a relatively healthy yield for your investment.
Real estate company CapitaLand, which owns three shopping centres in the district, is a key player in Jurong East's transformation. I spoke to Teresa Teo, the organisation's head of retail management in Singapore, about how the announcement of the new rail terminal will impact things on the retail front.
With Jurong Gateway already being an up-and-coming business district and with the location of the high-speed rail terminal in the area, Jurong Gateway will certainly become more attractive as an office location for businesses as well as retail opportunities. So as more businesses choose to relocate or expand here, the enlarged population catchment will provide a major boost to the retail prospects of the Jurong Gateway. So retailers will serve not only local residents and working professionals, but will also serve the business and leisure travellers accessing the high-speed rail terminal.
Jeremy Toh there from our Singapore Bureau. Still to come on today's show, we'll hear from Australian fashion designer Dion Lee. And Kenji Hall fills us in on a new retail transport hub in Tokyo. I'm Ben Rylan, and this is Asia Pack Unwrapped in association with ANZ.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
This is Asia Pack Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. I'm Ben Rylan. Dion Lee has been heralded as one of Australia's most exciting prospects in the world of fashion design, gradually building his eponymous label into an international business from its base in Sydney. While seeing a strong growth in Europe and the US, the brand has also set its sights on the emerging Asian consumer interest, and Dion Lee recently took up an offer from Singapore Fashion Week to show alongside major name designers such as Diane Furstenberg and Victoria Beckham at the international event. Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles caught up with the Australian designer before his show to discuss the label's strategy for growth in Southeast Asia, the pros and cons of operating a global design company from Australia, and he asked why the brand decided to join the international event.
We really saw this as an opportunity to focus on this market and develop this market. We've seen really considerable growth in our international wholesale business over the past 12 months, particularly in the past season. I think international wholesale has close to doubled for us. So we've had a really strong growth in the US and we've been focusing a lot on that region. I'm presenting collections at New York Fashion Week on a seasonal basis, and moving forward, I'll be spending more time being based there. So that's really exciting. And yeah, the next thing for us is really focusing in on regions that require development for us, including Asia. We have a network of wholesalers throughout Asia, but we really want to raise the visibility of the brand and I suppose create more of an identity for the brand for people who might not be as familiar with what we do and the background of the aesthetic.
It would be great to hear just how you're doing that. Obviously, you're showing here this week, but what other approaches have you taken to this market?
I think we're just really focusing on online visibility as well. I think that online is a big, an important component of our own business, and we're really trying to work with our online retail partners within this region.
And we've talked about the business side, but it'd be great to hear a little bit more about the creative side and yeah. I guess how your designs have been received here in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we find that each market approaches the brand in a different way. The great thing about Asia and particularly Singapore is there are a lot of, I suppose, lifestyle parallels to being based in Australia and, yeah, dealing with the climate, I suppose. I find that can be a little bit more of a conservative market in Singapore. So they're definitely more attracted to the classic elements of the brand, I would say. But yeah, I think that the important thing about presenting our collections here is really to show the scope of the brand and to show that we are really approaching the wardrobe from many different perspectives.
And you're based in Australia, and the fashion industry there, it's been quite turbulent in recent years. There's been some well-known brands that have gone into administration. It seems like it's a tough place to base a label from. Would you be able to share with us some of the challenges that you have working in Australia, but also maybe some of the benefits as well?
Sure. I think the geographical situation of being based in Australia is one of the biggest challenges, the fact that you're so removed from other markets, but definitely not something that we're unable to overcome. I think that as an Australian brand, you just accept that travel is part of your job and definitely becomes part of the process of being present in other markets at all times. And the seasonality, I would say, is the other thing that we find quite challenging, being that it is a very summer makes up 60% of our season, and even our winter is quite warm by comparison to other places in the Northern Hemisphere. However, I think that that's kind of shifting a lot as well in terms of international retailers looking for more trans-seasonal collections and the amount of retailers that are selling online and the fact that online breaks down seasonality a lot for the consumer makes it a little bit more easy to design for, I suppose. But I think that the past few years, I've really learned a lot of that through experience in terms of how we structure a collection and how we do things that work for Australia and do things that work for different markets.
How do you see Australian fashion right now? And do you feel like when it's sort of a smaller community, it's important for Australian designers to kind of band together, or is it more, you know, you want to offer a variety in design in Australia?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that any industry needs to support each other and grow from each other and feed off each other in many ways. However, I think that it's important for each brand to stand alone and not be grouped together, because I think that, yeah, like any industry, it really needs to be about what's strong about each particular brand's DNA rather than being seen as a collective.
That was Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles there, chatting with Australian fashion designer Dion Lee. This is Asia Pack Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. A new retail and transport hub has sprouted up in Tokyo, not all that far from our bureau there, actually. Monocle's Asia Editor-at-Large Kenji Hall joins me on the line from our Tokyo bureau now. Kenji, the place has become quite an example of mixed-use mastery, hasn't it?
That's right. It's called Node Uehara. It opened in late April. It's 5 floors, 4 above ground, plus a basement level, and it has, in the basement and ground floor, it has a restaurant, deli, and grocery store. And the upper floors, it has some residential units. And on the very top floor, there's an office space. This is a line that runs from Shinjuku, which is Tokyo's busiest railway terminal, all the way out to points along the Pacific coast and to Hakone, which is a tourist area near Mount Fuji. It runs right by our neighborhood here. And along this railway, you have relatively small developments. It's mostly residential. And so what Odakyu Railway, the company that runs that train line, has done is they've created this relatively small-scale commercial, residential, office type of project, and they've tried to make it extraordinarily unique by not doing the typical thing. The typical railway project is what's known in Japanese as an ekibiru. This is the Japanese word for station building. It's usually bland, filled with chain stores, maybe some restaurants. It's a convenient place for commuters to grab a quick bite or do a bit of grocery shopping before they go home. But it's not really a destination. It's not somewhere you'd want to go if you had the choice. And so what makes this Node Uehara project unique is it could actually bring people to the Yoyogi Uehara Station area, which is a bit out of the way, off the beaten track.
So what's pushing this new concept for the development of the retail and transport hubs? Is it something that is coming from like a grassroots movement from the people who actually use these sorts of services? Or is it something that's really being pushed from maybe the higher end of the property development market?
I think it's a little of both. I think they're saying that the old business model of just putting up an ekibiru that's bland and that nobody really wants to go to has run its course. That what we're seeing now are these very, very small scale, independently run shops that are actually attracting a lot more people and drawing away business from the ekibiru. And so the railway operators who own quite a lot of property along their own rail lines, they're finding that they have to compete with that and that they have to do something different. In this particular project, they created an all-star team, really. They got a chef named Masayo Funakoshi. She runs a well-regarded farm-to-table restaurant called Kiln in Kyoto. They also got our friends over at Landscape Products, a design firm run by Shinichiro Nakahara, to help them find products from all over Japan to fill the grocery store. So it's not your typical grocery store. It's higher end. It's got very, very niche type products. And these are products that are hard to find anywhere else.
Kenji, something that we've been keeping a close eye on here at Monocle 24 is the concept of gentrification. And it's a topic that popped up at our recent Quality of Life conference in Lisbon as well. What is the Tokyo view on gentrification? And would you say that the appearance of a retail and transport hub like the one you're talking about here, is that a symbol of gentrification? Is that something that's becoming more common in some parts of the city?
Yeah, gentrification is a really difficult topic to talk about here in Tokyo because there are only a few areas in Tokyo that are downbeat and sort of areas that you wouldn't normally go to. Here, it's more sort of the difference between a bustling, sort of centrally located shopping and restaurant area versus a more sleepy residential area. And as I mentioned before, this is more of the latter, the sleepy residential type place. So, you know, in many ways, this is bringing a little bit of that more bustling retail and restaurant aspect to a sleepy area. I'm not sure how it will transform the area. So far, you know, there's been quite a good response. It's quite popular. So, you know, so far the signs are good that they're hitting their core audience and that, you know, this will be a success. Incidentally, it's also the first of many projects that they hope to do along their train line in the future. And so I think this is not the only time you will hear about this.
A story to be continued indeed. Kenji Hall there, Monocle's Asia editor at large. This is Asia Pack Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Up next, we'll take a trip to Australia's cultural capital for a chat with the city's Lord Mayor. We're nearing the end of this week's show now, but just enough time to take a quick flight over to my home city, Melbourne. Recent years have seen Australia's southern capital boosting its reputation by playing host to several international events. But some argue that Melbourne's mission to increase its presence on the international stage is having a detrimental impact on its historical integrity. After a golden age of apartment complex development throughout the late 90s, the city's central business district has been transformed from a 9-to-5 business hub into a burgeoning 24-hour cultural hotspot. Monocle's Carlotta Ribello had a chat with Melbourne's Lord Mayor Robert Doyle. She started by asking the Lord Mayor what's prompted the city's shift in focus from apartment construction to hotel developments.
Well, we continue to develop apartments very, very rapidly. Last year, just in the central city, we brought 6,300 new apartments online, and we will do about 5,500 new apartments every year for the next 4 years. And that is just the central city. But at the same time, Melbourne's hotel accommodation has been thriving as well. And we have developed, you know, if we're back at 2012, there were about 14,500 commercial accommodation rooms in the central city of Melbourne. Well, that has grown remarkably. And if you look right now, just at last year, there were nearly 900 hotel rooms under construction. There were 1,400 rooms that had planning approval, and over 4,300 had applied for planning approval. So it is a very big boom in hotel accommodation to match what's happening in building of apartments.
And is it correct to say that the city sees itself as a kind of a business hub?
Absolutely. We see ourselves as an event hub, a business hub, a convention hub. If you think of 2014, we attracted the four big medical conferences of the world to Melbourne. So diabetics, cardiology, pediatrics, and the huge AIDS conference. No other city in the world has delivered all four of those medical conferences in one calendar year. And that's a source of the prosperity of the city. We continually go out to try to attract the big conventions and to be on some of the smaller, more influential conventions as well. Now, if you are going to do that, we have to put together a package for people which includes activities, the conference itself, travel, and certainly accommodation. And for the big events, you need a range of accommodation, from the quite modest and budget-minded all the way through to five-star plus. And that's certainly what we're trying to do. But meantime, even in country, Melbourne is now Australia's number one overnight tourist destination. So it's the diversity of things to do, whether they are cultural or sporting or recreational or hospitality or retail, that's attracting people to the centre of the city. And what you're seeing is commercial room, hotel development, scrambling to keep up with that demand.
So I would assume that then the business traveller is fairly important in Melbourne. And why is that?
Well, we think the business traveller is a crucial part of what we do. I mean, we are a hub for major industries like the superannuation and pension industries and other financial industries, but biotech, research, particularly pharma research, clean technology, education, advanced manufacturing. These are all areas in the knowledge economy where our city is generating new jobs at a very rapid rate. So we're going through a very vibrant period of growth at the moment, whether that is business, whether it's hotel room construction or whether it's residential construction, to house those new knowledge sector workers who want to live close to where they work in affordable but nevertheless very stylish accommodation.
And are you concerned at all that the city's identity might be changing too quickly with all these redevelopments?
Look, the city's identity is changing, but we are very careful to protect that feeling of Melbourne. You know, one of the things that we have been bequeathed as a great legacy are the great gardens of Melbourne. Now, we could sit back and simply say, aren't they wonderful? But in fact, at the moment, we are planting 3,000 additional trees a year. So we're rethinking the way that we model our city. We are very careful of the urban design of the city. We have world figures like Professor Rob Adams, who has guided the urban design and development of the city for the last 30 years and continues to do so. But at the same time, we are a modern city that is changing and must respond to the changing needs of business and what makes the city prosperous in things like conventions and events.
That was Melbourne's Lord Mayor Robert Doyle there in conversation with our own Carlotta Ribello. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. The show was produced by Nolan Giles in Singapore and by me, Ben Rylan, right here at Midori House in London. Nina Norick was our editor and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Asia Pac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That is, of course, 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington and 2200 hours Sunday here in London. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes, SoundCloud or, of course, the Monocle app. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Until next time, I'm Ben Rylan. Enjoy your week.